And good afternoon, everybody. Glad you're with us today for Midday on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Election Day is 2 weeks from yesterday. Early voting starts tomorrow. Today on Midday, a conversation with the leading candidates for the 3rd Congressional District. Incumbent Democrat John Sarbanes first won that seat in 2006. He's been reelected to the House 4 times since then. He is 54 years old. He was born and raised in Baltimore, a graduate of Harvard Law School who worked as a lawyer for 17 years before running for Congress. He's the father of 3 children. He and his wife Dina live in Towson. His father is retired U.S. Senator Paul Sarbanes. His Republican challenger is Mark Plaster. He is 64 years old. He's a doctor whose medical specialty is emergency medicine. He also holds a law degree from the Widener University Law School in Delaware. Dr. Plaster owns a medical publishing company, which he started some 30 years ago with his wife. He's a former naval reservist who deployed twice to Iraq. Originally from Missouri, he and his wife Rebecca have lived in Annapolis for the past 20 years. They have 3 children and 7 grandchildren. John Sarbanes and Mark Plaster join me in Studio A. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Plaster, let me start with you. You're a physician. You got a law degree. You started a small business. Now you're running for Congress. When do you figure out what you want to be when you grow up?
Actually, I've been an emergency physician for 30 years. I never really transitioned out of any of that. I trained at shock trauma, in fact. And the law degree was so that I could really understand how health, how the legislature and the law, particularly liability, was affecting us. You know, I sat for the bar and passed it and helped with a couple of cases, but that's really not, has never been my my profession. I got into publishing because I was invited by the Bureau of National Affairs to become the editor of a medical legal publication in my spare time. So I started writing healthcare policy and advising physicians and about the interaction between legislation and the medical practice. So when I proposed a project to the Bureau that I thought would be helpful to our specialty, they really didn't bite on it. And so I launched this little magazine from my basement, actually, on a picnic table, and which then, over a period of years, morphed into the largest and probably most successful emergency medicine magazine called Emergency Physicians Monthly. We added, a few years later, Emergency Physicians International that has gone to 15 different countries, and now we recently, 2 years ago, launched a new magazine called Telemedicine, dealing with digital advances and how that's going to change the face of healthcare. We could talk about that at some point, but
so why politics now?
Well, it's real simple. When my son was at the U.S. Naval Academy about to graduate in 2002, a passion was rekindled in me. My grandfather was the only survivor of a trench hit in World War I and lived his entire life as a disabled veteran. My father, all 3 uncles were fought in the Pacific in the Navy in World War II, and my son was at the U.S. Naval Academy. And I found an opportunity to join the Navy Reserve Medical Corps in the spring of 2001. Obviously, in the fall of 2001, our lives changed. And my son and I were kind of a historical anomaly in that he and I are one of the few fathers and sons in American history who fought in the same war at the same time. In 2002, we both were preparing to go to Iraq. He was a part of a guided missile frigate that did the shock and awe, and I was the head of a shock trauma platoon for the Marine Corps that provided forward deployed medical care. I came home with a real passion for veterans, having been one and also having seen injuries and the bravery of our veterans. I came home and found that the follow-up care, certainly the most egregious injuries were cared for tremendously, but our veterans from Korea, Vietnam, World War II, were wound up in the morass of the VA system.
So it's the issue of veterans that has propelled you into this
race? It really changed me. I really felt like that our government was not taking care of our veterans. And John and I hit John pretty hard because I think that he's been a part of a system that has let this happen. and I want to be kind to him personally, but I want to point out that I think he's on the wrong side of several issues related to veterans. And
so we'll certainly talk about that. And Congressman, this is by many counts a change election. There are people mm-hmm. who are pretty down on politics at the local level up through the national level. Mr. Trump makes a big issue of the fact that he's not a politician. We had a couple folks running for mayor of Baltimore who made a big deal about that very same fact. You have been in the House for 10 years. Speak to the folks who are cynical about politics and politicians in particular. Your one of your big, you know, marquee issues is campaign finance reform. But at a time when there is such cynicism about government and about the people who are running it, what do you have to say to those folks?
Well, Tom, first of all, thanks for having us on the show today. There's no question that there's a feeling of powerlessness out there on the part of many, many people. And I think in particular when they look at Washington and Congress and so forth, they feel like their voice is not being heard. They think that special interests, big money, and a kind of insider crowd is calling the shots when it comes to public policy. And when you kind of trace things, often that's the case. So I understand why people are angry and frustrated and cynical. And two things happen in that kind of environment. You get some folks that get very angry and they kind of rush into the political arena. And they express that anger in some, you know, challenging ways. But even, I think, as unfortunate is you got a lot of good, solid citizens who throw their hands up in the air and walk away from the political arena and away from civic engagement. And we need to bring those people back. And I think one of the ways you do it, there's a lot of different reforms we can engineer for our democracy to make it more responsive to people. One of them is to fight back against the influence of big money, rein in these super PACs and these secret dark money groups that are pouring money into our politics, which is a really kind of insult. It's an offensive insult to the American people when they see that. But also empower small donors, everyday citizens to kind of step up and push these campaigns forward so that when it comes time to make policy, the lawmakers feel accountable to the broad public instead of being captured by these special interests and these big money folks that kind of run the show too often. So there are reforms that we can put in place. And if we do that, we can begin to kind of work our way back towards a sense of engagement, ownership in the democracy on the part of the public. If we don't do it, then I think we're going to continue to see this anger, and that wave of anger is going to continue to crash down on our politics every 2 years, which is what we've seen certainly ever since I've been there.
So you brought up two issues here. So let's take them one at a time. Veterans, we've got veterans and campaign finance reform. Dr. Plaster, as a congressman, what do you think you could do? What could you achieve to improve the function and the efficacy of the VA and to improve the lives of veterans in this country? I mean, you're one of 400 and however many, right?
Right.
How do you do that?
Well, there's two things. And one of the things that John and I differ on. The first, I think, is everyone recognizes the deficiencies that are the VA health system. The stories just go on and on. I mean, they're hilariously terrible. My father-in-law made an appointment and got his appointment 13 years later. Okay.
When was that?
Just recently. He tried to make an appointment with the VA, and they called him just he tried to make an appointment 13 years ago, and they called him not too long ago, so they had an appointment for him in New Jersey. But the Baltimore Sun had reported that there were like 800-day waits to get the initial benefits through the VA. We need to reform the VA system, and the legislative way that we attacked that was the VA Accountability Act, and it had to do with trying to get people out, fire people who had committed fraud, who were incompetent. Everyone working even inside and outside the VA system understands that there's dead wood. There are people who are incompetent. There are people committing fraud who are maybe not in the right place, too many people.
But that act was passed.
It was passed with no help from our representative. And John voted against it twice.
And do you think it's moved the needle? I mean, do you think it's helped?
It hasn't been enacted. But
you expect that the clearing out the deadwood. I mean, this will allow folks to dismiss people who are not competent.
Right. If you talk to VA employees, they will tell you story after story of employees who they can identify that were not performing, incompetent, fraudulent, and the system does not allow to get them out. And it becomes so clogged up from a bureaucratic standpoint that you can't fix it. You can't fix it. The second thing, and because healthcare is such a big issue, and it bears on the account of the Obamacare, I prefer to call it the Affordable Care Act, out of respect. But the Affordable Care Act is imploding of its own financially. And one of its replacements on the Republican side was offered by Congressman Tom Price, friend of mine, orthopedic surgeon from Georgia. H.R. 2300, I encourage your listeners to take a look at it. It is a repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act that is open to veterans. They could opt out of the veteran system and obtain health care straight through the private health care system. We can talk about the aspects of 2300, but one of the things we need to be able to offer veterans is to get out of the VA system completely and offer them private health care, and that's one of the issues.
Yeah, Tom,
Congressman, talk about those votes and talk about your take.
Sure. I mean, the bill that Mark is referring to, I mean, it's an easy thing to try to message around. Because it had the name VA Accountability and Modernization Act in there. But frankly, what it did was it would eliminate some of the basic due process that an employee would have in the VA if you are trying to move against them. And I agree, if people are acting fraudulently, if they're acting with incompetence, if they're not respecting our veterans, which is the primary responsibility you have when you work for the VA, then we need to take action to discipline them, and that includes termination. But if you streamline the procedures that are available to them so much that it eliminates the due process, the danger is that they aren't getting their constitutional due process and they have to be reinstated at the end of the process. And we've actually seen that happen in a couple of cases. So I want to take action, but I want to do it in a way that means that if somebody really deserves that termination, we can follow through on it and it will stick. Now, I think there are things in the VA that need to be fixed. And absolutely, if there are these long waits to get your first appointment, we have to address that. And we've actually taken with prior legislation some steps to do that, increasing the number of primary care physicians that are being hired by the VA so that you can get those first appointments more quickly. But we need to be careful because there are many veterans who will tell you that the services that they're getting through the VA healthcare system are outstanding. So let's be careful. Let's go in and fix these problems where they exist. Let's take care of people that aren't doing the job. But you don't want to, you know, throw the proverbial baby out with the bathwater. And I don't think you want to get into this wholesale notion of sort of outsourcing some of these critical services that are now provided to our veterans through the healthcare system, through the VA, to some other entity or some other organization, because you may discover at the end of that the services you're offering to our veterans who deserve the best services possible are not meeting the standard that we would be comfortable with.
Dr. Place, a quick point. We're going to take a break.
The first VA Accountability Act that John voted against, the difference between the first and the second was current VA employees have 365 days of paid leave during which they can due process out. No one in the private sector has that kind of due process rights. If you committed fraud in this in your role right here, you'd be escorted to the parking lot. You know that. I'm not saying that's what it needs to be, but the second one lowered it to 77 days, 77 days of due process. If you can't due process out an employee in 77 days, something is wrong. The process, I think he points out the problem. It's so sluggish that you can't seem to get it done.
And isn't part of the problem just how to legislate this kind of stuff? I mean, coming up with laws that are overarching that fix all situations is a difficult thing, and it's a challenge that anybody in Congress confronts. We'll come back and have more. Dr. Mark Plaster is running for Congress as the Republican nominee in Maryland's 3rd District. Congressman John Sarbanes is the Democratic incumbent who was first elected in 2006. Nanabu Eze is running in the 3rd District as the Green Party candidate. He appeared with me here on Midday a few weeks ago. You can hear all of our conversations with the candidates this election season when you come to our website, wypr.org/midday. Going to take a quick break. Coming up, your questions and comments for Congressman John Sarbanes and Dr. Mark Plaster. You can reach us by sending us a tweet at Midday Tom Hall. You can drop us an email, midday@wypr.org, or give us a call, 410-662-8780. 410-662-8780. I'm Tom Hall, back after a quick break. And welcome back, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. By the way, coming up tomorrow, two scholars from Johns Hopkins assert in a new book that it's not really the politicians who run the government. Instead, it's the 2.5 million civil servants that make the decisions that have the biggest practical impact on our daily lives. Jennifer Bochner and Benjamin Ginsberg join me to talk about their new book, What Washington Gets Wrong, The Unelected Officials Who Actually Run the Government and Their Misconceptions About the American People. So as you can imagine, they've got a point of view on that subject. And coming up Friday on the broadcast, incumbent Representative Dutch Ruppersberger and Delegate Pat McDonough will join me for the hour. They are running against each other in the 2nd Congressional District. If you're just joining us today, my guests are John Sarbanes, the Democratic congressman who represents the 3rd Congressional District, and Dr. Mark Plaster, the Republican nominee for that seat in next month's election. The 3rd District sprawls over the state, including narrow slivers of Baltimore City, as well as Baltimore, Howard, Montgomery, and Anne Arundel counties. If you're interested in joining our conversation, we'd love to have you. Give us a call at 410-662-8780. Drop us an email, midday@wypr.org, or send us a tweet. Our handle is @MiddayTomHall. Dr. Plaster, let's talk about campaign finance reform. The Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court changed in a dramatic way the influence of corporate and individual money in the political process. Do you support that decision? Where do you stand on that? And what is your view of Congressman Sarbanes' efforts to reform campaign finance?
The Citizens United wasn't a piece of legislation. It was a Supreme Court bill that was a Supreme Court decision that was based on free speech.
The court, right?
Okay, to overturn a Supreme Court decision is a long, long-term process, and so I really think that free speech, political free speech, is an underpinning of our nation. Now, dealing with John's approach to campaign finance reform, I think it's kind of interesting that John's sitting on $1 million in cash, talking about controlling big money. And incumbents have a very, very difficult time unseating. Challengers have a very, very difficult time unseating incumbents because of the money that they sit on. I'd be more than happy to share equally in John's money and equal things out, to have required public forums where we are able to repeatedly debate so that everybody in the district sees our views. I don't think it's about money per se. Even PACs, you know, teachers put their money together to form PACs. Doctors do. Broadcasters do. It is only, and we've demonized those people to say that they are the problem in Washington. The problem in Washington is that our system currently just brings the same people back year after year after year. John has a famous name because of his father. To get name ID is almost impossible. He has franking privileges because he's a congressman. Free mail, that cost me a fortune to challenge him. The last two people who ran against him, one had $500 and got 93,000 votes. One had $5,000 and got 41% of the vote. You know, I just think that we need to even the playing field and having the taxpayer pay into a campaign coffers, as what John's bill proposes, will only increase the amount of money in politics. It won't decrease it, and it certainly won't level the playing field.
Congressman, your bill called the Government by the People Act, you introduced it in 2014. One of the things it does is provide a $25 tax credit for campaign contributions. Would it, as Dr. Plaster suggests, level the playing field? Would it make it less complicated for challenge incumbents?
You know, Mark complains about the advantages incumbents have. I agree with it, the fact that incumbents have advantages when it comes to the money because of the current system. If you're an incumbent, you got all these special interests that come at you, right? And they want to help you out. And so a challenger who's trying to get in there and shake things up would have more opportunity to do that if we had a small donor matching system for funding campaigns than they do now. I applaud that. I embrace the idea that someone with good ideas who's hustling, who's out there recruiting small donors to support their campaign and invest in their campaign can earn some matching funds and then become competitive, right? And be able to run a competitive race for Congress or for council or whatever it might be, state legislature. And when you look around the country where they've put these systems of small donor matching funds in place to help candidates run and fund their campaigns, you're seeing that. You're seeing people that have served their community, they want to step forward, they want to run for elected office. They're not kept out anymore by the money because they can access sufficient funds that they can go make a competitive race. And the other thing I'll say is, you know, Mark complains about this notion that the public will invest in this system. But the choice is, who do you want underwriting campaigns? Do you want the pharmaceutical industry to be writing the checks for campaigns, in which case they're going to ask for some special deal where we can't negotiate with them through the Medicare program? Do you want Wall Street to be underwriting the campaigns, in which case the small business on Main Street is going to get thrown under the bus when it comes to tax reform? Or do you want the American people to step up and say, you know what, we'll power the campaigns in this country, and in return, you go to Washington, you go to Congress, and you work for us. You're accountable to us. That's the promise of this kind of small donor reform. And if we do that, that's a very important step in being able to restore people's confidence in their democracy and feel like they have ownership again, not just of their politics, but of the way governing happens in Washington. That's why it's so absolutely critical that we pursue these reforms.
Dr. Plaster, quick comment, then we're going to go to the phones.
If you think politics is expensive now, wait till the government is funding it. There are lots of different ways to level the playing field. We are a debtor government right now. What we spend, we're actually borrowed. We're $20 trillion in debt. What we spend today on our elections, as John is proposing, we are borrowing from our children and grandchildren to do so, and it will only get more and more expensive. We could enact reforms, as I was saying, where I had, for instance, challenge.
Is your objection then that it's too expensive or that it's the wrong way to go? I mean,
it's the wrong way to go.
The Congressman's suggesting that if we spread whatever the cost is, whether it's too much or too little, that cost would be spread out with small donors rather than the pharmaceutical industry and Wall Street.
It's fundamentally flawed because he's actually proposing taking money from taxpayers to pay for campaigns. And it's a 6-to-1 in his bill. It's a 6-to-1 reimbursement up to $100. So someone gives him $100 or gives me $100 or whatever. I'm not making it personal. It's matched by $600 from the taxpayers. They may or may not agree with me, and yet their money, or more accurately, their children and grandchildren's money.
It's an investment in your democracy, okay? And right now, you've got, look at the oil and gas industry. They get $5 billion in tax subsidies. That's money coming from the taxpayers every single year. You could pay for the kind of system we're proposing 10 times over just by closing that one subsidy. Or look at the pharmaceutical industry, which doesn't have to negotiate with the Medicare program. 40 million Medicare beneficiaries cannot negotiate with the pharmaceutical industry for better pricing. That's tens of billions of dollars every year from the taxpayer going to the pharmaceutical industry. So the public just needs to make up its mind. Do they want to own the system, in which case it'll work for them, or do they want to turn it over to these special interests and big money crowd out there, in which case that's the direction that Washington will lean. And I think that's why people are so angry now, because they feel like the special interests and the insiders are running the show.
All right, this is a very important issue, but we've got many other issues that we want to take up. David is on the line from Columbia. He's a constituent of the 3rd District. And David, you have a comment about climate change. Welcome to Midday with Congressman Sarbanes and Dr. Plaster. David, are you there? I guess you're not there. We'll go to Carrie. She is also a constituent of the 3rd, coming from Towson. Carrie, welcome to Midday with Congressman Sarbanes and Dr. Plaster. How you doing? So we're having a little trouble with our phone lines today. Let's talk a little bit while they're getting those worked out. Let's talk a little bit about the ACA. Congressman Sarbanes, the costs are going up. They are going up because the pool of people investing and purchasing plans through the ACA is less healthy than originally was intended for it to be. Estimates about the raise in costs are somewhere in the 20% to 25% range, depending on the state. What's the fix for this? Is repeal and replace the right idea, or are there things about Obamacare that can be tweaked?
Well, first of all, when you talk about the Affordable Care Act, you have to be specific. The premium rate hikes that are being discussed over the last few days relate to what's happening in the health insurance exchanges that have been set up at the state level or at the federal level for people that didn't have access to insurance. That's one component of the Affordable Care Act. Now, it's an important piece because you want to broaden access for people, give them access to this kind of coverage, and those kinds of premium hikes present real challenges for families out there. I do have to point out that many of the families that are in the exchange can also access tax credits to help them cover the cost of those premiums, and the tax credits will also be enhanced, so that will help defray some of the cost of the premiums. But we got to look at trying to make that more manageable for people going forward. I support the idea, I always supported the idea of adding a public option into the mix, for example, where people could buy into the Medicare program, for example, and then you get the benefits of a Medicare program which has very low overhead costs, can be very competitive in terms of the pricing against some of these other plans that are out there. So we don't want to repeal the Affordable Care Act because there's so many components of it that are doing terrific things for people right now. We need to build on it. We need to make it stronger. We need to, you know, refine it where that need exists. But when you're talking about the Affordable Care Act, remember you're talking about other things. You're talking about protecting people against discrimination based on pre-existing conditions. We've eliminated that issue for people. We're talking about young people being able to stay on their parents' health care until age 26, which has made a difference for millions of people across the country. We're closing the donut hole for our seniors, which was really impacting them in terms of the cost of prescription drugs. We're eliminating out-of-pocket expenses for some of our seniors for wellness and preventive care services. So there's a lot of things about the Affordable Care Act that you don't want to throw away. You got to build on it. You got to improve. You got to refine it. I'm certainly determined and dedicated to do that. I sit on the Health Subcommittee of the Energy and Commerce Committee. I'm in a position to be part of that conversation and that effort going forward. So let's be smart about this.
Dr. Plaster, I mean, does H.R. 2300, the bill you mentioned a little while ago, which does call for the complete repeal of the current law,
that's right,
replacing it, does it do those things? Would the 20 million people who've been insured under the ACA continue to be insured under this legislation?
Absolutely. In fact, it would offer a refundable tax credit to every American, every single American. There are so many flaws in the Affordable Care Act. Just everybody knows. I tried to buy insurance for my wife the other day because we're leaving the selected reserve system. Her premium was $1,200 a month with a $13,000 deductible. I mean, that's ridiculous. That's absolutely that's like no insurance at all. And that's been seen by so many people. The HR 2300 would allow to have a refundable tax credit. It would cover have a high risk pool that would cover the folks that are eating up the majority of healthcare costs right now. It would allow veterans to opt out. We're talking about privatization. It does not force them to, but allows them to opt out of the VA system. It would, the most important part is it would actually lower the cost of healthcare. As a practicing physician, I can tell you that.
Of course, they predicted the same thing about the ACA. You comfortable and confident that would happen?
Yeah, well, because I'm a physician. I know what causes the costs. That's the key. I've actually been on the inside of the system, and I will tell you that the cost of defensive medicine, you're familiar with that term, where doctors order tests, do procedures, do things that they don't necessarily think are necessary, but they do them because they're fearful that if something untoward happens, they end up wearing the liability of that through a system that holds us strictly liable for so many different things. The HR 2300 would, because it is a federal system, would then allow us to restructure malpractice into federal health courts that have safe harbors, which have actually been proposed by Democrats and Republicans, which would establish standards of care that we can actually rely on. Right now, every single time you go into a court of law, you can't figure out what the standard of care is. And so it literally floats from case to case.
If cost is the issue, then you need to look at the fact that since the Affordable Care Act was put in place, the premium increases for employer-based health insurance out there have been very modest. That trajectory has been brought down.
It's just been shifted to the private market.
Averaging about 3%. If you want to deal with the cost for people that are in these health insurance exchanges, then create more competition, put a public option into the mix. Medicare, as I say, is one of the most efficient programs for delivering health care that we've ever seen. Overhead costs of 3%. So I've supported from the beginning when we were first putting the ACA in place, and I support it now as an improvement. Let's have a public option so that people going into these health insurance exchanges can access what has been one of the most successful health care programs in not just in the history of this country, but in history, which is our Medicare program. We can keep that strong, and we can make it available so that others can benefit from it.
But it only works because we have private health insurance that's actually carrying the freight. It's like going onto an aircraft where you've got frequent flyers and cheap seats that are being subsidized by the people buying the expensive seats. Right now, we have people who are privately insured who are carrying the freight for people in Medicare and Medaid.
Their costs have gone down. Their costs have gone down since
because
the Affordable Care Act.
Because they've shifted them to the private insurance market. That's the reason why they're costing $1,000 a month in premiums and $13,000 deductibles.
No, I'm saying the cost of people that are in the private commercial health insurance system, which is 170 million people through employer-based health insurance coverage, those premiums, that the acceleration of those premiums has diminished over the last few years, and it's averaging about 3%. So, yes, we have to focus on what's happening in these health insurance exchanges, which in Maryland—
The exchanges are failing.
Which is in Maryland about 180,000 people.
Yeah, and it's
out of seven, you know, out of
the exchanges are failing.
There's only six
of 23 that are still out there.
We're going to take a break, but it comes down to, in a certain way, you know, given the fact that the ACA occupied so much of the first Obama term in 2008, is it best to scrap that whole thing and start all over again, or is it better to take what is there and see what works?
Conceptually, obviously, there are some, you know, as I've said, a broken clock is right twice a day. There's some things in the—
Well, this clock is right 20 times a day. It's right on what you're doing for young people who can stay on their parents' health insurance.
Only
it's
if
right
they don't
for
marry.
Seniors.
Only if they don't marry.
It's right for our seniors or the donut
hole. It penalizes the people who marry.
And we will come
it's
back.
It's doing
and,
a lot of very good things for a lot of people. Including 20 million people who now have health insurance.
We will come back. We will come back after a break. And I understand that our phone lines have been fixed. That's good news. Dr. Mark Plaster is the Republican nominee for the congressional seat in Maryland's 3rd District. He's running against incumbent Democrat Congressman John Sarbanes. They are here with me in the studio. By the way, there's a candidates forum tonight at 7 o'clock that both Representative Sarbanes and Dr. Plaster will attend. It's sponsored by the Anne Arundel County League of Women Voters. It's at Woods Memorial Presbyterian Church on Annapolis Boulevard in Savannah. Verna Park. We've got a link to the details on our website, wypr.org/midday. And by the way, there's also a mayoral forum in Baltimore City tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at Coppin State University, sponsored by the League of Women Voters of Baltimore City. This afternoon, we'll take more of your calls and comments when we return after a quick break. 410-662-8780, midday at wypr.org is our email address. At Midday Tom Hall is our Twitter handle. Stick around. Welcome back to another edition of Midday on Politics. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, we're having a conversation with the two leading candidates for Congress in the 3rd District. Joining me in the studio this hour, Democratic incumbent John Sarbanes, who is in his 5th term in the House, and Dr. Mark Plaster, a physician, a lawyer, and a small business owner. He's also a veteran. He is seeking public office for the first time. I understand that our phone lines are back up and running, so thanks to the folks who've been patient waiting so far. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number 410-662-8780. You can also drop us an email, midday@wypr.org, and send us a tweet at Midday Tom Hall. Let's try the phones again. David, you're calling from Columbia. You have a question about an issue that has not seen a whole lot of attention in the presidential campaign, certainly, and that's climate change. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Yes, I'm calling about climate change, and I'm concerned about how much humans are causing it. I had a two-part question. First, I just wanted to make sure that both candidates agree that humans are causing climate change. And second of all, then what do they think Congress should do about it?
Dr. Plaster?
Yeah, I'd like to. John's
Republican nominee for president does not believe that humans are causing climate change.
No, that's not correct. Well, I think that there's a lot of factors in climate change. First off, we all agree the climate does change, that we have short cycle and we have long cycle climate change. Anybody who goes outside knows that the climate changes. Anybody who's flown over the U.S., the Southwest, knows that at one point was probably covered in water. So we know that there are ice ages. So we know that there have been drastic climate changes that man has not been involved in. It doesn't mean that we're not involved in it now, but we really have to be very, very careful that we don't drastically alter things that we may or may not be able to completely alter. One of the things that has been proposed is a complete abandonment of any other fossil fuels, nuclear, a variety of other things, and the result of that would be really catastrophic for our economy, for jobs. It would cause energy to rise dramatically. And those kinds of steps are really damaging, particularly to the people in the bottom rungs of our society.
So what's your answer to David's question? Are human beings causing climate change? Do you believe the science that says that climate change is a man-made dilemma?
Not totally. I don't believe that it's totally man-made. The question is whether if the policies that have been proposed, if we were to adopt all those, would they in fact dramatically turn the earth around? And I'm not convinced that that would be the case. I'm just simply saying that we need to adopt all those things, but we need to be very cognizant of the damage we're doing to our fellow man as well in the efforts to try to save the planet.
Congressman Sarbanes, climate change is an issue that you've work on.
I'm disappointed that Mark is not more directly acknowledging the role that humans have in climate change. I think there's no question when you look at the science, you know, 97% of scientists agree.
John, that's bogus, and you know it.
That's not bogus.
That's
97,
bogus.
And you're a physician.
That's,
if 97%,
that's a number that has been concocted from bogus research.
97% of physicians gave you a diagnosis, and 3%
that
was
number
against
is
them,
bogus.
You would go get the treatment. So 97% of the scientists are saying that climate change is being directly impacted by what we're doing on this planet.
You can say that forever, and
that's
it's just simply...
That's the diagnosis. That's the diagnosis. So the question is, what's the treatment? Are we going to do something about it? Are we going to limit our carbon footprint? Are we going to limit carbon emissions? Are we going to take constructive steps, which, by the way, also can contribute to our public health? If we're reducing the amount of coal that's being spewed into the air, we're helping public health as well as addressing the issue of carbon emissions that are creating climate change. Tom, we did a hearing of the Energy and Commerce Committee at the Naval Academy on this very topic because the city of Annapolis is now experiencing 50 flooding events a year, okay? 50 flooding events
a year. I'd like to comment on that.
On the dock, the city dock down there, because the tides are rising, sea levels are rising. We did a hearing there. The superintendent of the Naval Academy, Vice Admiral Carter, Ted Carter, came and testified. He says the Navy operates at sea level. That's what we do. We have to pay attention to these issues. And so people that are on the front lines of dealing with climate change are taking it very seriously. They're taking the science seriously about this, and they're looking at policies that we can implement at all levels that will make a difference for our environment. So I think you have to embrace this, the science on this, and then move forward with policy solutions that make sense.
So do you not believe,
Wait,
Dr. Plaster,
I'd like to respond directly to his issue of the nuisance flooding in Annapolis. Shortly after I met with the Capital Gazette editorial board, and they made a big point of the fact that I didn't believe in climate change as evidenced by the nuisance flooding in Annapolis. I was approached by a Smithsonian associate who studies archaeological changes in the Bay and noted that their data set started in 1960, which actually coincided with the building of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel across the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, which coincided with a shallowing of the Chesapeake Bay, which coincided with an increase amount of water in the bay at low tide, which would cause expected nuisance flooding in the upper and middle bay. The point being, yes, it is man-made.
But is the point whether the science is 97% of the scientific community or 92% of it, do you not accept that a majority of the scientific community attributes climate change to many of the things that humans are doing?
We are involved in it, and you're missing the point. He's trying to tell me that the nuisance flooding in Annapolis is evidence of climate change. I'm telling you that people who actually study this say that it's not. It's not related to that. It's related to the Bay Bridge Tunnel that was built.
All right.
And so it's an example of how that people will see that the rising of the water in the Chesapeake Bay, oh, it must be due to climate change. And it's probably not related to climate
change.
We're
going to get off this topic
That's crazy not to see the linkage there. The Union of Concerned Scientists released a report where they attribute the increased incidence of flooding in Annapolis and along the shoreline there to the effects of climate change and the impact that humans are having with respect to climate change. You can go through these gymnastics to avoid the science, but at the end of the day, the data is there,
right,
and we have to accept it and move forward.
Thank you, Congressman. We're going to move on to another call. This is my next question, but I'll let Bill state it. Bill is calling from Baltimore. He is a constituent of the 3rd District. Bill, welcome to Midday with Congressman Sarbanes and Dr. Plaster.
Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, I'm one of those voters that is kind of angry with the way that things are going on, and I'm looking for some changes that are ongoing. And I think we've got two presidential candidates that offer different views. And Mr. Sarbanes, I already think I know where you stand on this. But Doctor, do you endorse Donald Trump as the presidential candidate of your party?
A lot of attention has the answer to that is yes. A lot of attention has been placed on his statements and maybe past behaviors, and I think that it's very clear. I've said this before in other settings. It's very clear that Jesus is not on the ballot this year, neither is Mother Teresa, and we need to look at more than and just the rhetoric that's on both sides, but the platforms and the platforms that Mr. Trump stands for, which are lower, stimulating our economy through lower taxation. Increasing our security through a better enforcement of our border security. There's a whole list of things that he stands for. increasing the rule of law through enforcement of existing laws. These are things that I can stand by. Obviously, his rhetoric, if is proven to be his behavior is inappropriate, I'd be more than happy to
denounce that. Do you think Donald Trump is temperamentally qualified to be the president of the United States and deal with this?
Yes, I do. And I certainly compare. I know people who have worked with Hillary Clinton on the opposite side who are Secret Service individuals who find her to be explosive with them, degrading with them, calling them deplorable names, not just deplorable, but using language that you or I would to their faces. And these are people who would lay their lives down for them in the Secret Service. We see it. They see a different face and than the public persona of Hillary Clinton. People who know Trump in private universally find him to be a kind, gentle man. Some have even,
of course. And there are people, congressmen, who know Mr. Trump in public who find him to be a misogynist and a racist.
This is the thing. I'm amazed that Mark would say that that Donald Trump has the temperament and judgment to be president. Given the statements he makes just about every single day, Trump makes, and you know, Mark keeps saying that Mother Teresa and Jesus are not on the ballot. Well, I agree, they're not on the ballot. But the fact that Mother Teresa and Jesus aren't on the ballot doesn't mean you turn around and endorse somebody like Donald Trump to be the next president of the United States. I have serious misgivings about whether this man, Donald Trump, has either the judgment or the temperament to hold that position of president in a responsible fashion. I have confidence that Hillary Clinton will be able to do the job. She's been in the Situation Room. She's shown that she has the experience to handle these tough issues. And so I'm very happy to be supportive of her. But the notion that you would endorse Donald Trump, particularly after what he's been saying over the last few weeks, is amazing to me.
Well, that is all the time we have, gentlemen, and I appreciate both of your being here. Obviously, the divides in this election are very reflective of the divides that we see on the national level. Thank you very much, both of you. Dr. Mark Plaster is the Republican candidate for the House of Representatives in Maryland's 3rd District. He's challenging incumbent Democrat John Sarbanes, who has held the seat since 2007. We've got a link to more information about this race and a link to both candidates' websites at our website, wypr.org/midday. Election Day is 2 weeks from yesterday, and early voting begins tomorrow. And speaking of tomorrow, Jennifer Bochner and Benjamin Ginsburg will join me on Midday to talk about their new book. It's called What Washington Gets Wrong, The Unelected Officials Who Actually Run the Government and their Misconceptions About the American People. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review Anne of a Thousand Days. That's at the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company, and that's all coming up on Midday Thursday. And looking ahead to Friday, a conversation with Democratic 2nd District Congressman Dutch Ruppersberger and his Republican challenger, Delegate Pat McDonough. Lunch for our guest today was provided by the Baltimore Chef Shop on the Avenue in Hamden. They offer a variety of private events and cooking classes for kids and adults, including baking and international cuisines. Tomorrow evening at 6:30, they're offering a vegetarian Greek cooking class. More on the web at baltimorechefshop.com. Thanks for everybody. Thanks to everybody who called and tweeted and emailed. Thanks everybody for listening. We will be back tomorrow at noon. Stay tuned now for Here and Now. That's coming up after the news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.